I'm Eric Allen for KLCC. Hank Pander has been one of Oregon's most foremost artists for the past half century. Since arriving from his native Netherlands, his vivid and intense work has ranged from depictions influenced by a childhood growing up under the Nazi occupation to official portraits of Oregon Governors Tom McCall and John Kitzhaber. In conjunction with the Lane Arts Council's First Friday Art Walk in Eugene on November 6th, he'll give the month's art talk at the downtown Lane Community College campus at 6 p.m. He joins me by phone at KLCC. Thanks for your time today.
Sure, you're welcome.
Well, when you arrived here in Oregon, how did painting Oregon help you to find your personal relationship to the place?
Well, it was a considerable sort of cultural leap on my part, and at the time I was young. I was about 26, 27 when I got here. I came out of just the heart of Amsterdam. I had studied at the State Academy of Fine Art. I had done the Prix de Rome. I just came out of the heart of the Dutch art world, and my father was an artist. I grew up in the arts. And so I was actually in many ways just completely formed as a Dutch sort of emerging artist, and I actually was quite successful at the time in Amsterdam. But I had met a American woman who was from Portland, and we got married in Amsterdam, and she wanted to see her family, so we came out here. And I came out here, basically completely naive. I had never even heard of Portland, Oregon in school. I knew, San Francisco, and knew where Seattle was, and Los Angeles, and New York and stuff. And I had a very superficial, knowledge about the United States. But at the same time, I always thought that if I was going to live abroad in some foreign country to sort of explore, the larger world, because the Dutch art world now holds a small country, and the art worlds, as all art worlds are, turn out to be, are somewhat insular. There was a kind of predictability about my life in Holland, and I thought, in order for me, when I settle in Amsterdam as a working artist, I needed to have a broader experience of the world. And at the time, I thought that of all the countries in the world, the one which would, quote, sort of be somewhat predictive of the future. And I spoke fairly good English at the time. I thought the United States would be actually, to live there for a year, that would just be amazing. And so maybe even subconsciously, I led sort of my life sort of in that direction. I made American friends in Amsterdam. And I used to translate for UNESCO students at the academy because I spoke English, and some of the faculty out there didn't. And so I sort of drifted in this direction a little bit. And then when I came here, it was like, it was in the mid '60s. It was in the middle of the Vietnamese War. I in order for me to get here, I had to have a job, and so I had applied. I had met Mike Russo, who was a Portland artist in Rome in '63. And so through him, I was introduced to getting a teaching position at the Museum Art School here, which is now Pacific Northwest College of Art. But I had, I had never taught. I had never done any public speaking. I was just right, quote, straight off the boat, so to speak. So I had really no experience. And I also was really not particularly comfortable in public speaking. And I had to address the world in a foreign language. And at the same time, I just sort of landed here in the middle of the, Portland, Oregon art world, to which I was completely, utterly unprepared. And also the concerns about what artists were involved in, the whole cultural background with people, education and art school and vision about the arts and all that was really, from my point of view, was coming right out of Amsterdam, was, practically alien and somewhat threatening and really quite disconcerting. I had to sort of, and at the same time, a lot of my students were, you know, about my own age. I was really young, so and the faculty, you know, was somewhat aloof and you know, not overly friendly, I thought. But students were really great, and they, you know, they were probably intrigued by my Dutch accent and stuff. So I befriended students, and they were the ones who took me around Oregon and took me to the coast and took me to the mountains and sort of exposed me to American culture, of which I really didn't know very much. So I had to really educate myself really very fast and sort of absorb this culture as quickly as possible and sort of adjust myself to it so I felt comfortable here. So it was a very intense period, and it was also sort of frightening in many ways and scary. I was, you know, all of a sudden my financial situation, you know, compared to Amsterdam, practically collapsed. There was no real money here. People didn't buy art. The payments in that school were just minuscule and stuff. So it was an incredible adjustment. At the same time, it was also really quite thrilling. So, and it was the first time in my life that I was away from my family and the kind of social control which sort of exists in the Netherlands, where everybody knows everybody and everybody minds your business and is opinionated and sort of. And here I was totally in this huge country on the west coast of the United States, totally on my own wits, my own ability to survive. And so it had also kind of a sense of, you know, personal freedom. You know, that was kind of how it started.
Do you think that being from elsewhere allowed you to see things in Oregon artistically that those of us who were born here might miss?
Well, I would think that would sort of be presumptuous. It did sort of, and still this, and I hope I never lose that in a sense, that sort of looking at the world from the outside or seeing the world fresh or, you know, and always sort of comparing it with, you know, I think you get formed really early on, and my aesthetics were formed early on, my exposure to art was formed really early on. So in a sense, I was really quite formed. And although I've been tremendously influenced by living here, that sort of initial kind of upbringing and my, you know, my antecedents, my sources in a sense are really clearly established in the Netherlands. And so, so in that sense, I've always sort of looked, you know, sort of in a natural way, in a sense, just look at it like living in a foreign country. Although I've adjusted well to it and stuff, and I've, you know, been marginally successful, but at the same time, I'm always, you know, startled about its politics and its history and its incredible turbulence and its innate violence and its incredible upheavals in it, and the size of this country, the enormously different climates here, the enormous landscapes, the great tensions, and, you know, and people's backgrounds are really very different than mine. So in that sense, it does have a way for me to sort of, you know, and I, you know, kind of, I can't help it, but look at it somewhat from, you know, from a distance.
When you start to see the developing themes of your work over the course of a long lifetime, what kind of repetitive themes do you see, or what kind of narrative do you see developing?
Well, I don't really know who ever said it to me, but a long time ago in Holland, one of my friends in Holland said, you know, the only thing you can really do as an artist is paint a picture of your time. And, of course, that's an incredibly broad, sweeping comment, but I've taken it, you know, somewhat literally, in a sense that I did make an incredible journey, in a sense, a huge cultural journey, and at the same time, you know, assimilating this culture in America, and at the same time retaining a sense of a personal identity. Yeah, I started looking from, well, what am I doing? What am I supposed to do here, you know, as an artist in this huge place? And I thought, well, since I've always, in Holland, always worked in a landscape and worked on documentary projects and worked for the city of Amsterdam, to, you know, to make drawings of the changing life and the structure and the visual sense of the city. And I had commissions for the Dutch government to paint like big Dijkbergs project as the Netherlands sort of strengthens itself against the sea. I would commission artists to make paintings about these enormous national project. And so that sense of like looking at the world and documenting and seeing a change, and also this kind of this sort of industry and the, you know, the machines of culture, in a sense. It always intrigued me, and I did, and I just continued doing that, except, you know, living here. And at the same time, there was also enormous cultural turmoil. You know, there were, when I got here, there were huge, you know, peace demonstrations and anti-war movement, and you know, my students of mine were hauled out of class, and I had to fight in Vietnam, and there was... you know, I was in a country at war, and the last country at war I remember was my own, and when I was a little kid. So I made these kind of connections. And so in some ways, I continued what I was doing already in Holland. This transitional period is really kind of interesting. You see my last drawings at Amsterdam and my first drawings at Portland. And they're stylistically very similar, but they're very different worlds. And so gradually... I ended up being sort of absorbed in living here, and the economics of it was that it was so incredibly stark here. There was no government support. There was no resources I had here. I didn't know anybody. And at the same time, I grew up with the idea of living off my work. So without any kind of connections or help or any kind of, you know, family or old professors or whatever kind of support system, it was extremely difficult also to, you know, to actually survive here as a working artist. And so I had to sort of, you know, explore everything I knew how to do. And I knew how to draw. I won the Portrait Prize of the Netherlands, the Therese van Dale Schwarze Award in you know, 64 in Amsterdam. So I thought, well, portraits. Maybe I can do portraits. Or I had, you know, there was a little theater which started here, and I had done set design courses and all. And I thought, well, that'd give me at least kind of also work in the theater, give me kind of a sense of community and being around people and working on, you know, fairly large scale projects without having a studio and all that. So I started working in the theater. And so gradually, I you know, I climbed myself up, you know, my bootstraps. And, you know, I had, my father also was a graphic designer and illustrator and stuff, so I knew how to do lettering. I knew how to draw posters. You know, I had, you know, an excellent background and skill, so I was rather versatile. And all of that together sort of made it possible for me to at least make a meager living at it.
One of the portraits that you ended up doing here was Oregon Governor Tom McCall, and that portrait was apparently controversial at that time. Why was it controversial in your estimation?
No, you tell me. I have been blessed with the notion of being controversial in the moment go out here. So, and it startled me because I'm actually rather not necessarily conservative, but I live a fairly, you know, I'm a hardworking sort of, you know, I'm a serious person. I try to be responsible and try to do the best I can. So, and the same with that portrait. I met Governor McCall. You know, he was already ill, but he was just, you know, very, incredibly wonderful man. I just instantly liked him. He's just incredible charisma. He was really incredibly tall and sort of striking person. We instantly liked each other. We just got along really well. I had done research, you know, research, so I sort of knew I wanted to paint a portrait of him in a setting which he had influenced, the setting of the painting would reflect on his governorship, so to speak. So I discovered in his autobiography, you know, the beach bill and his efforts to that, mm-hmm. and that he went to the beach and measured, you know, with OSU students, but he measured the beach and what the beach really represented in terms of its relationship with the ocean. And so that, you know, that idea of doing a grand measurement and measuring the American continent, the interface of the continent and the great oceans and the forces of nature which determine, you know, the floods and the receding floods, and him standing at the edge of the ocean with a 16-foot pole making this grand, I mean, he sounded like Isaac Newton. And at the same time, he was sort of like this grand figure in Oregon history. So the whole thing fell together really quite naturally. And he was also standing at the edge of his own life, so because he was actually basically standing with one foot in his grave because he was gravely ill. And so I went to the beach. I went to Cape Mears, did studies there on the beach and stuff, and there's some great, you know, logs out there. And I painted him sort of as a low horizon. And I asked him, he stood in his yard, and I took photographs of him. And he said, you know, no, Governor, you're on the beach now. And I'd oriented him sort of towards the sunlight so the light would be, you know, proper in it. And I said, you know, you're meeting one of your citizens, you know, what do you do? And, you know, he shook his hands and waved his arms and all that. So I had all this really wonderful documentation on him. And then I went to his home when he was really quite ill, and I drew a portrait of him from life, which is now, I think, in the Oregon Historical Society. So I actually spent literal time with him, you know, becoming really acquainted, and we had great conversations. And then at the very end, I had done an underpainting on it. I had actually somebody pose for it, so he didn't have to come to the studio and stand for it. I had really excellent photo documentation also. And at the very end, the very last sitting, he was already very sick. I took him to my studio. We borrowed a station wagon. My girlfriend, later my wife at the time, Dolores, said, you got to talk to him and keep him busy because he's really engaged and all that. And so, while I painted, you know, the details in his face and, you know, so the last layer, especially on his face, it really painted some life into it. And so I really was, you know, very serious, and I thought I was really quite thoughtful about it. So the whole controversy to me, also kind of, to me, surprised me, as it still does, actually, mm-hmm. why it was controversial. I think the foot in the water, you know, but it was also the symbolism of standing, you know, between these great forces of nature and stuff and making this measurement and have it being that by itself was already, I thought it connected these two realities. And So I don't really know why it was controversial, frankly.
The intensity of your work surrounding growing up under the Nazi occupation is undeniable. What do you want to communicate about that experience to those of us who didn't have to experience that hard history directly?
Well, to me, these paintings are kind of more like allegories. And I was just a little kid during the war.
Mm-hmm.
I was little. And however, the end of the war, when the southern Netherlands was already liberated, the Nazis still were above the rivers, and that was just an extremely bitter winter. It was just, and there was just massive famine. And, you know, people were persecuted and murdered, and it was just dark and cold, and there was nothing to eat, and there was no electricity, and there was no fuel, and there was terror, and my father had to hide, and all that, you know, and I was like seven. So I was the eldest, and so I had to be, you know, extremely aware of my environment and stuff. So if a Nazi soldier would ask me, where's your dad? because they wanted to pick up all men, all young men. I had to say, oh, my father is in Germany. So I had to lie to the soldiers. And, you know, we didn't have to hand out, you know, illegal papers and stuff. I mean, we were surrounded by, you know, this incredible drama, except when you're a kid, you don't know any better, you know. So but the greatest mystery of mine was, what is a banana or so, you know. There's all the bananas bent and it's yellow and there's not any seeds in it. It was the most mysterious object ever. So that sense of fear and that sense of adventure, and then later on becoming aware of what we actually really lived through, and that was just the biggest crime ever committed in the history of mankind. Of course, and then landing in America, and it's actually, ever since I've been here, I've been here for 50 years, and it's been in perpetual war. So you know, you can't get away from it either, and it may not be happening there, but bombs fall on other people's heads, you know, and they're all humanity. So it also makes you kind of conscious of it. And then some years ago, I had a big commission for OSU. I did two murals in the Memorial Union at OSU. And one of these murals had to deal with World War I. And so I was drawn to the subject. I thought it was extremely interesting to do a mural about that, and he's saying that he didn't want to have a war scene in it. So I went down to France, and it happened to be my sister, you know, and a theater ship, and they were staying right around Verdun in the ship out there. And I stayed with them. And I had at Powell's Books found, like, the Michelin Guide to the Battlefields. There's a little book which came out in, like, 1930, and it had his photographs in it for his, you know, former army officers who wanted to visit those battlefields out there. And so it was this incredible book with all these ruins and towns and forts and craters and trenches and, you know, massacres and, you know, and all these little pictures in it. And it had also this little picture in it of the Church of Montfaucon. And Montfaucon had this enormous battle that the Americans did. They liberated these hills of Montfaucon with an enormous loss of people. There's an enormous cemetery out there. But that the ruins of that little church out there, it was a Gothic church that had these arches in it, and the murals had this sort of arch shape too. And I thought, well, that brings together the American effort and brings also together a deeper history, like the Gothic, you know, the kind of timelessness and the setting of the landscape where the. So by roaming around on these battlefields in northern France in the springtime, looking for blooming poppies, I discovered that the whole First World War was still imprinted in the French landscape. The trenches were still there. I found helmets. I found machine gun trees. I found enormous bomb craters. Bullet riddled churches and all this. All, if you look carefully, battle wire and these old forts. It was all there. It was incredible war memorials, and so it was turned out to be this much more moving experience than I had really even imagined. And that made me sort of interested in if, like, history or war or conflict could be imprinted in the landscape, and if similar kind of things were imprinted in the American landscape. And so I started looking for these links between my life and, you know, surviving the Second World War. The Americans actually, they liberated. If it weren't for the Americans, I would not be talking to you right now. So I was starting to start looking for these kind of battlefield-type landscape which made these kind of links between my own childhood and living in American stuff. So all these kind of connections. And, you know, gradually, with my sort of background in Holland about this sort of documentary period, my work sort of slowly shifted into these kind of directions, sort of independently from, you know, whatever is happening in the art world and stuff. So that's kind of how it sort of develops, sort of naturally and personally at the same time. You know, history painting is interesting to me. So it has a sort of historical element, but it's they're kind of allegorical more than anything, I think.
And as you look ahead in your late 70s now, what is there artistically that you still, what artistically keeps you alive and looking forward?
Well, I don't know. I'm just, you know, I was working this morning. I'm working on a big painting. I like painting still. I'm painting these enormous still lifes. I go paint in the desert quite a bit. In fact, I just came back from a painting trip in southern Oregon in the Malheur Wildlife Refuge where I made watercolors. And I do that. I have a trailer. So I make this occasionally when I sort of feel I get restless and stuff. I take my van and my trailer and I go far afield and sort of look for new things to paint. And I load like big sheets of watercolor paper in my van, and then I go on, you know, really extensive journeys and make, you know, big, fairly big paintings on the road. And then oftentimes they translate themselves again into paintings, and I may manipulate them and add things to them or change them and all that, and I become this sort of American landscapes. I find things, and you know, and I have collected like, you know, remnants of animals and stuff. Like I have a whole horse skeleton, I have a cow, I have a whole bunch of, you know, creatures I find and stuff, and they're lying around the landscape, and they're also they remind me of 17th century Vanitas paintings, and also they say something about, you know, the wilderness and the animal kingdom and the violence in this country and the, you know, the rawness of it and stuff. So, and then I bring them here in the studio, and I have these animals, I wire them together and suspend them from the ceiling, and I make this enormous still life, build this huge installations and stuff, and I make big still life. I keep myself really busy. I don't even think about how old I am. I just, you know, I wear the work. Then I have the still life, and then before I take it down, there's so much work to put one of these things together, and I think, well, it's got another painting in it, and then I alter it and make a different version of it and stuff, so... It's not like, you know, the difficulty living here in this area is more not my that I don't have any ideas for paintings and stuff. It's the economics which are really very difficult. Mm-hmm. Difficult doing this kind of work I do doesn't fall in the marketplace. It's not trendy. It's people think it's, you know, they have this Americans have this world called tough. Or paintings and stuff, so it shies people away and all that. And so that part, I find the economics extremely difficult. And the kind of people who would, you know, be able to afford my paintings are probably not the kind of paintings people I would spend a lot of time with and stuff. So there's oftentimes a real disconnect between the, quote, market and the kind of paintings I do. I find that more difficult than, you know, me making paintings. I love to paint.
Well, thank you for your remarkable work and for taking time to talk about it today.
Sure.
Hank Pander, who will give this month's Art Talk as part of the Lane Arts Council's first Friday Art Walk in Eugene on November 6th. His talk will be held at Lane Community College's downtown campus beginning at 6 p.m. It's free and open to the public. For more information, lanearts.org. And for more on Hank Pander's art, hankpander.com. For KLCC, I'm Eric Allen.